Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Stay tuned for an interview with Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman about his book, Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'm talking with Dr. Robert Thurman. Dr. Thurman is the author of Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness, a book about Buddhist social ethics, which we'll talk to him about a little bit. And I like this interview, this introduction to Robert Thurman, written by Eric Davis. He says, "No contemporary Western Buddhist fuses scholarship and popular desire with the panache of Robert Thurman, ex-monk, Columbia professor, Tricycle magazine honcho, Tibet House president, father of Uma, an American point man for the Dalai Lama. Thurman plays the Orientalist scholar as Buddhist impresario. He hobnobs with movie stars, writes books for academics and seekers, and lectures with a charismatic fire that have led some to dub him the Billy Graham of Buddhism." Now, in your book, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, you talk about the need to have a libertarian civil rights regime and individualism. You talk about the way that government resources should be spent. And a lot of it is an interpolation of the ideas of compassion and free expression and individual liberty that are implicit in Buddhism.
Right.
And a lot of people have responded to that platform by saying that it's heavily influenced by your current historical and cultural context. How much do you give to that critique? Or do you think that...
Well, I haven't heard that from a great many people. Maybe you've heard from more people than I have. I had not actually heard that very frequently repeated. Maybe people say that. But, of course, everything one does is influenced by one's own circumstances. However, my argument is not just sort of spouting Thomas Jefferson and saying that that's Buddha, but rather I'm using Buddha's own statements and interpreting them and his own actions, where he, you know, broke his own social obligation to be king and went off instead to become a Buddha, disobeying his father's law and the rule and the custom of his country and even the religion of his time, as indicating what I call transcendental individualism, meaning that the individual's duty to their own evolutionary fulfillment is higher than their social obligation, and that a society that accepts that norm is a society that is truly individualistic. And actually, I critique my current circumstances, where in America, you know, you have to, like, serve the government, and you have to serve the army, and you have to serve the family, and so on. And the idea of monasticism in Protestant America is actually not favored. And people think of that as selfish, and you could never have, like, an Indian sadhu here, somebody who walks naked in town and gets a free lunch. You know, even the Hare Krishna people look down on in our country. So I don't use that as based on some American thing. I use that as a critique of the American self-pretense that they're very individualistic, but actually being very conformist and insisting that people follow a certain life pattern and join the army, et cetera, and rah, 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 you know. And not to mention a critique of the pre-Buddhist authoritarian Indian society. So, you know, I make my arguments based on my analysis of the social situation of that time and the statements of the Buddha and of Buddhist writers, you know, since that time, and not just sort of saying some sort of American democratic ideal and you know, then just asserting that that's found there. I bring it out of the statements of the people there.
So you do think that Buddhist societies have been distinctive in a cultural and political sense?
Absolutely, and that's why I'm very clear in the book, in almost all the Buddhist countries, Buddhism remained what I call countercultural, because the mainstream societies, including India, were still demanding much more conformity and collectivism of their citizens, and China, too, and Japan. And although they did allow Buddhist monasteries to exist, which opened them up a lot, they still kept those monasteries very much under the control of the state, and the state still had its most powerful institution in the society was the army. And the only countries that implemented what I would call the full Buddhist social program were Tibet and Mongolia, where monasteries became the state, and the army was completely disbanded, and the country was unilaterally disarmed, and people were therefore free to pursue their individual self-conquest to the fullest, rather than being coerced into a national military to go and conquer others. And so that's actually much more radically individualistic than America, or any, you know, than the modern American democratic theory would allow. Although I insist that the underlying drive of democratic theory really is the freedom of the individual, and therefore democracies are not supposed to be militaristic. And in fact, the militarism of any democracy subverts that democracy, as we are seeing today in our country.
That account that you just gave...
Now you're getting very faint again.
Oh, okay. The account that you just gave of Tibet as having been a fairly liberal society...
Do I count the fate of Tibet?
The account that you've given of Tibet as a fairly liberal society, a society that allowed people to pursue their own lives.
Right.
Other people, and especially to the Chinese, have critiqued Tibet as having been a feudal country, a traditional feudal country, where
right.
there was a lot of serfdom and slavery and so on.
Right.
How much do you give to that critique?
Well, that's just propaganda. The Chinese had working some Marxist Western intellectuals who actually are still in Beijing, I think, some of them, and they put them up in a nice, comfortable compound and had them cook up this whole story, which fit with the Western Protestant ethic ideas, and sort of tried to depict the lamas and Tibetan Buddhism as a kind of Borgia-esque, you know, like corrupt Italian feudal place, and because they thought that would make the Western countries feel, well, too bad, they aggressed on Tibet and they destroyed it, but it was like a bad place anyway. And that was just propaganda. Tibet was a feudal country until the 16th century, as, no doubt, just as Europe was and as other places were. And, you know, it was sort of medieval and feudal. But since the 16th and 17th centuries, Tibet has developed a very unique type of society that is relatively, I think, extremely free. There were no prisons. There was no real prison system, even, hardly. It was a few small jails, but mostly people would be publicly, you know, humiliated or something if they've committed a crime, most crimes. And, you know, in this stockade type of thing, you know, stocks, you know, rather than being incarcerated, and then they would be released after some period. And everyone was free to be a monk or a nun if they wanted to, but of course not everyone wanted to. And there was no army at all, which is extremely different, you know, socioeconomic emphasis than most every other country. And feudal means, you know, where feudal lords have serfs who are always soldiers in their army, and they're always fighting each other, and they have a network of allegiances under which they fight. And the serfs are just property of the lord. The lord can kill them at will, and that was not the case in Tibet since the 17th century. Just as in West, you know, it ceased to be available since the 17th century. So the Chinese propaganda is just wrong, that's all.
Now the Dalai
and there are books, not just my book, but if you look at Rebecca French, The Golden Yoke, The Legal Cosmology of Tibet, Franz Michael, a sociologist called Rule by Incarnation, The Tibetan Polity, and so forth. There's a number of books that show the remarkable and unique nature of Tibetan society, although I must say everyone has been baffled, and I was too until the last 10 years or so of studying Buddhist history. Everyone was baffled by a country where 20% of the population were monastics. Because it is very baffling to our sort of modern Protestant modernity, where we think of monasteries as something archaic and Catholic and therefore, you know, left behind in the Industrial Revolution and the rush to conquer the world, you know. But actually, if you really figure it out, monasticism is the one institution in world history that was able to help a society overcome the disease of militarism.
Because if you're not a soldier, you're a monk. If you're not a monk, you're being a soldier.
Well, yeah, those excess manpower, you know, and these sort of wild people who are kind of like not going to live just a normal life between the traces, you know. If they what they do in most societies is they join the army and they go out and like beat people up and they ravage and loot and pillage, and you know, the sort of Rambo types. But in a society where there is no such channel, they tend to go into monastic orders and become one of those Zen monks who bangs their head on the wall every day for 30 years until they get a better idea.
But in Tibet and China and Korea and Japan, there were armed monks, or at least some.
There were what?
Armed monks, monks who took up arms.
Not really very many, no. That's what, again, the Protestant historians sort of try to point to. And in Europe, too, there were some monks who went on some crusades. There was Friar Tuck, right, who was dishing it out with Robin Hood, right? So there are some exceptional cases, of course, where monasticism was re-co-opted by militarism, both in West and in East. But for the most part, the monastic was non-armed. The whole vow of the monastic was not to take up arms. Monasteries were asylums against the violence, where people would flee. And the basic thrust of monasticism was people who were sick of war and who were looking for a different battle, a battle with the inner demons, this kind of thing. And but, you know, that kind of example of the occasional mad monk type of thing is always used by people who don't understand the institution to try to invalidate it as a social institution. The fact of the matter is, historically, that the countries that abolished monasticism, which are the northern European countries 400 or 500 years ago, are the countries that went out through imperialism and effectively conquered the world. And they developed the current world polity, which is, as we know, a polity of universal militarism, wouldn't you say? Like, America is a country of universal militarism.
Yeah.
And the five United Nations Security Council powers are all the biggest arms dealers, and they sell weapons to every other country as their major export. And so we were really in a case of world militarism, because we have no world monasticism. You know, my thesis, if you will, in Inner Revolution about the value of monasticism, it was not one that I easily came to, even though I was a monk for 4 or 5 years in my 20s. But then afterwards, I sort of adopted the view that, which is the view of modern Buddhism, in America anyway, that monasticism is sort of obsolete. Most of the major American Buddhists who, you know, lead groups and communities are sort of ex-monks. And then Japanese Zen masters in America are married. And they call themselves monks, but they're actually married. Or they have girlfriends and things.
I'm actually an ex-monk myself.
Exactly. So, therefore, the theory is, you know, that was my theory, too, when I became an ex-monk. You know, I thought, oh, great, here in America, you know, we're all ex-monks and we don't need that old-fashioned stuff. But then it took me, like, 20 years of study of history and a recognition of my built-in Protestant ethic biases, you know, studying sociology, to realize that I was completely missing the key peace institution, you know. It's like the Pentagon is the war institution in America, and the peace institution, there isn't any, except the occasional peace march, which then everyone has to go back to work, you know. They only can get together on a holiday. And the permanent peace institution, the equivalent of the peace army, is only the monastic thing, and we've lost that in America. That's why our peace movement is so pathetic. And I only came around to that as a sociological idea, and I was shocked, actually, to come around to the idea.
But I'm fully aware
that in Tibet, for example, where they were demilitarized for 300 years, they were eventually wiped out, and they're under genocide right now because they couldn't fight. They didn't have an army. And so, you know, to be unilaterally disarmed in the world, in a militaristic world, is very, very dangerous. And it's only really in a sort of little bit New Age perspective where you see the world as having this problem of self-destructive universal militarism that the Bush administration, for example, perfectly exemplifies, where really they're leading us down a path of world destruction, really. And when you're in that context, you suddenly say, hey, everybody has to unilaterally disarm is the only way. You know, it would then be multilateral, of course, if everybody did it. But that's the only hope, is if everybody does it, because the idea that somebody's going to conquer and dominate the world, and then everybody else is going to arm to, and there'll be arms races forever. Of course, that will destroy the environment. It will destroy the population. It will destroy everything. You know, nuclear. You know, like spent uranium fuel shell casings all over the place. Come on, you know, there's no way to survive that.
But you know that in some Buddhist countries, there are the traditions such as upasikas who take a temporary set of vows. And I wonder whether we need such a rigid division between the laity and the monastics, because a lot of lay people like myself and my wife, we like to go on long meditation retreats and do things which would have previously been reserved only for monastics. Take ordinations, empowerments.
That's good, because that's fine, because, and that's possible in the West at the moment, because the West has the economic surpluses available where people can be lay people and yet somehow make enough money in between or have enough money inherited or save enough money where they can then do that. But, you know, in an agricultural society, or maybe in, if, you know, if America was more, if it, once its economy has finished going bust as it is currently going, it won't be that easy to do that. And therefore, if somebody's going to do it, then the others are going to have to support them the way that it was done classically. You know, like being a monk is like the cheapest way of having a scholarship. You know what I mean? It's a minimalist way of having a scholarship from the rest of the society. And it still remains, I think, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I'm an ex-monk, too, and it makes me feel worried to think that I'd have to depend on the monastic vocation or those who are able to maintain it to really keep the Dharma really turning with intensity in the community. But instead of the half-baked way that I can do it, it makes me feel sad that I would not be one of those who would be more intense once I have a family responsibilities. But if you actually think about it practically, I think you begin to, and to see it sort of sociologically, I think you might begin to see the point that only sort of the full-time professional, you know, is the only way of really keeping it going. And in America, where, you know, we're having the militaristic group is taking away all our free time, all our free economics, all our social, our economic cushions, and all of our civil liberties, it's going to require people who don't have children to have to protect against marauding soldiers, you know, who don't have family responsibilities and who can be just as macho for nonviolence as the soldiers are in their violence. It's going to take that to be the counterweight to this incredible Ramboism that's going on. I mean, imagine, look at those guys in Iraq today, our fellow citizens of America, who are having to keep... They're basically behaving like Nazis with the local Iraqis, and when they're terrified, I don't blame them personally. They're getting orders, and they're in these compounds, all barbed wire in, and they're fighting it out with the citizens on the street. And let's say they do that for a year or two, then they return to U.S. How are they going to think of some people protesting in the streets in the U.S.? You think they're going to go for that? It's terrible what's going on, and who's going to really be able to resist these people? You and me, when we have the responsibility to protect a small child? I don't think so. Maybe an old man like me, once I've done that, you know, I'll get out there and go crazy because I'm getting old. But young, middle-aged family people who have wife and children to protect are not going to be able to withstand such people.
You, a couple years ago in...
What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you. I guess when I look around at the contemporary Buddhist monastic orders, I see so many men, especially in Asia, who got into monasticism for career reasons or for because of poverty, who really don't belong in the monastic order, and it creates a lot of discipline problems and a lot of laxity. And
that can happen.
Yeah, and but I
still,
certainly
even those except, I mean, if you're referring to Japan, then remember that those people who call themselves monks in Japan since 1867. Mostly are married. They are not celibate, actually.
Right.
You know, they own their temples. You know, the temples were made family possessions by the Meiji government to precisely weaken the macho government-resisting monastic orders, to make them family men. So they're not real monks. They call themselves monks, but they're not monks. And if you go, however, to Burma and the other places where they are actual celibate monks, even though some of them may be lax, at least they're not out beating people up in the street, you know. At least they're not like soldiers committing atrocities, you know.
No, but
you know what
in Sri Lanka there is a substantial following of the various political parties among the monks, and the monks, the politicization of the monastic order, if anything, you know, in Sri Lanka, I would argue for more apoliticism on the part of the monks rather than them seeing that they have any social responsibility, because the politicization of the Sangha in Sri Lanka has just contributed to civil war.
But I don't think that was started by the monks, you know. In other words, anyone who was an actual monk would have, of course, not been able to bear arms or encourage others to bear arms. If there are some corrupt ones, then that happened. And there was quite a bit of communist infiltration into the monastic orders in Sri Lanka before the thing really erupted.
Right.
And, you know, there's, you know, everyone points to, again, you see, the Westerners, with their addiction to violence in the Western societies, are really threatened by example of another country. It's like in academic circles, I had to do this debate all the time. Oh, well, we had the Crusades, but you guys are fighting in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, they're desperate for any excuse to sort of feel that everybody else is just as bad as they are.
Right.
But the fact is, the other people are not perfect. But the overall historical record is there's not any huge crusades. The Sri Lankan monks did not go and invade India. Do you know what I mean? To turn the whole of South India to the true Buddha. You know.
Right.
They did not. They never did when they were a big majority there. You know. And
they all got wiped out by Muslims. So.
And yeah, exactly. So I mean, that's not quite as simple. It's more complex than that too, in that direction. But still, the point is that the basic thrust of monasticism is the point for all of the imperfections is the opposite of the military thrust. That's the key. That's the key insight, I feel. And therefore, you know, the idea that we can all get along without monks is naive, you know, as I have been, you know, as our generation, the liberals have been. We never, yeah, Eisenhower said military-industrial complex, but heck, we have the 60s, we had Jimmy Carter, we had Bill Clinton, you know, we have the Democrats, they protect us from these, you know, militaristic, military-industrial complex Republicans. Or did they? What happened now? Where are we?
Right. Well, let's, for the final part of this interview, I just want to touch briefly on the fact that a couple of years ago in Tricycle, there was a celebrated dialogue between you and Stephen Batchelor, which also illustrates some of the other issues that you take with contemporary Western Buddhism and American Buddhism, in particular, the kind of Protestantization, secularization, deculturalization, humanism, these dialogues, these incursions into Buddhism as you would probably see it. And one of the touch points here is your defense of reincarnation as a key element of the Buddha of the Buddhist practice. And a lot of Buddhists, Western Buddhists, would argue that reincarnation is irrelevant. Your attitude towards it and whether you believe in it is irrelevant to Buddhist
right.
practice.
Well, first of all, Batchelor himself doesn't really say that. He's just trying to like make something that can bring in some new people. But you said celebrated, but I don't think it was really that celebrated, except that the publicist of Batchelor's book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, of course, tried to hype that to make it into a big celebrated, you know. But anyway, it's going to be celebrated because I'm writing a book on the opposite direction that's going to come out next spring, which I elaborate at length how like the six paramitas and this kind of thing are meaningless, in fact. Mahayana Buddhism is meaningless and ridiculous. The Bodhisattva vow is meaningless unless it's set against the cosmological background of like the multiple life continuity world picture. And, you know, anybody who says I'm going to save all beings from suffering is just full of it if they think they're going to be nothing at death and they have another 15 years to work on their zendo. I mean, what does it mean to say I'm going to save all beings? That's ridiculous. I mean, it's completely meaningless. And so I'm really, and even Batchelor doesn't deny, that all the major teachers of Buddhism, Asian teachers from whom we learn Buddhism, and all the major traditions, simply assume the multiplicity of lives. It's a complete rarity in history that anybody would have the nihilistic notion that there is no such thing as consciousness, and therefore when you die, your body is gone, then you're gone. There's just no Buddhists who think that way. Ever in history, and even there's no people in any country. Most religious people in all countries never think that way. Tribal people don't think that way. The very few modern materialists, the modern societies are the first societies that have ever been dominated by an elite that tries to think that way. And look what they've produced, you know. What have they done to the elements of earth, air, fire, and water in our country? Food chain is poisoned, the air is poisoned, you know, the fire element is predominant with global warming. The water is polluted. They won't take care of the universe. It's just the way egotism works.
Dr. Thurman, you said that you have a book coming out on a defense of traditional Buddhist ideas.
That's right.
Is it focused on reincarnation?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's called Infinite Life, and it's basically a teaching of the six paramitas, you know, transcendent virtues, against the background of their being meaningful and possible to practice, against having cured oneself initially of the view that one is only here this one life. And that is posited as a fundamental in the Eightfold Path. You know, the first branch of the Eightfold Path is called right view. And in all of Buddhism, the fundamental wrong view is belief that there is no future life. So I'm pushing that argument, yes, very strongly.
Would you say that you're optimistic?
And I hope it does become celebrated, therefore, because I'd like my book to be widely read.
Well, I'm celebrating you right now. So
what?
I'm helping to celebrate you.
Good,
so there
good,
you go.
Excellent. I mean, and Steve himself, you know, he doesn't, they just try to hype him into that. He was just trying to say there's a way that people can kind of get a handle on Buddhism. They don't have to swallow the whole cosmology right away. And he himself said he's agnostic about form of future life. He didn't say he doesn't believe it. He just says he's agnostic about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the debate, he said. So it was just like hype by publicists to try to like make it like there was a big controversy, something new. Do you know what I mean? They want to always make something new about a book, you know.
It does seem, though, that there will be a form. It seems like there will be a form of deracinated Buddhism which will be pretty popular. You know, we saw recently the study of the PET scans of Buddhist meditators, which I think was actually conducted in Dharamsala, which found that people who practice Buddhist meditation are happier, biochemically.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't done in Dharamsala. There was a dialogue about it in Dharamsala. It was done in the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, University of Wisconsin.
Yes, in Madison by Richie Davidson.
And
Dan Goleman reported on it, and then some other labs are working on the same type of thing.
Yeah, Kabat-Zinn's work on trying to introduce.
Yeah, Kabat-Zinn didn't do PET scans, but he does that work in hospitals, yes.
Exactly.
It's great work, too. And that's wonderful stuff.
Right. And so it seems like for humanist, secular, rationalist Americans, there's a lot that Buddhism can offer,
sure.
Even without the cosmology.
Yeah, but you know something? The real nihilist types, you know, who are determined, like Daniel Dennett, you know, Steven Pinker, you know, all of those who are all bent out of shape by the idea that there might be anything like a soul or a consciousness or life after death or whatever it might be, because they're so scared of getting the Inquisition and the Church back on their case, you know, or getting their rabbi come over there and clip up their foreskin or something. They're so terrified about it that even you have a million PET scans, they'll pay no attention. They'll just say, oh, it's just like not statistically significant. So you can't really sell Buddhism by just pretending that it fits with some materialistic thing. I mean, it doesn't hurt that there's that. You know, some lay people might find it intriguing. But, you know, the real thing is people have to rethink. The whole point is that the view that the mind is nothing and consciousness is essentially reducible to nothing, and therefore the reification of nothingness into being the ground basis of the universe, is just completely philosophically naive and totally illogical and deluded and unscientific. That's the key point. So the burden is on those people to show that there's any way in which it makes sense to say that the continuity of anything, including an individual consciousness, can ever become nothing. So the shoe is really on the other foot, actually, if you think about it, even with a little bit of mental effort. But anyway, I think we've gone through the time here.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Robert Thurman. I've been speaking with Robert Thurman. He's the author of Inner Revolution, which was the reason for holding this interview, but many, many other books. He's a Columbia professor, an ex-monk. He writes for Tricycle Magazine. He's the Tibet House president. And I want to thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you. James.
You too.
You take care of yourself.
Okay.
Have a nice day. Good luck to you and your family.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.